This is Culturetopia, a look back at the best of the week's arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Neda Ulibi, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Felix Contreras, reporter for the Arts Desk and blogger for A Blog Supreme.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage from books and music to movies and television and everything in between. And you can find links to all of the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, Kenneth Turan reviews the not-so-good Woody Allen film starring Larry David. We've got Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts on fatherhood. And Felix takes us to the White House for a bit of jazz education. But first,
the film Bruno is opening in a few weeks. It's a satire starring Sacha Baron Cohen as a flamboyantly gay fashion victim. He's the guy who 3 years ago brought you Borat, the outrageously fake journalist from Kazakhstan. Sacha Baron Cohen is also the guy who sparked outrage and lawsuits because Borat was so offensive to many, many people. Now the studio releasing Bruno has started pre-screening it for gay activists and writers. And judging from the trailer, there's a huge list of people this movie could offend, not just gays. Neda, you did a story. Let's check it out.
What's up? I'm Bruno.
The character Bruno is Austrian. Some Austrians are reportedly less than thrilled with Bruno's assessment of the Austrian dream. Find a job, get a dungeon, and raise a family in it. So, Austrians, gay people, who else?
I'm Ted Milan Fashion Week.
Italians.
Yes, I'm going to wear the jumpsuit made entirely out of Velcro.
Definitely fashionistas.
You go out now.
Yeah. Euro trash.
Hi, welcome to Sears. How can I help you today?
You may find this very hard to believe, but I'm gay.
Okay.
Salesmen. Also, men.
Look at the four of us. We are so like the Sex and the City girls.
Women. Also, hunters.
I ain't either one of them. I'm Donnie.
That is such a Samantha thing to say.
Celebrities.
Angelina's got one. Madonna's got one. Now Bruno's got one.
Adoptive families.
So what's the baby's name?
I gave him like a traditional African name. OJ.
Babies. Africans, Americans, African-Americans, bingo players, TV presenters, terrorists, people in the military, Hasidic Jews, fetishists. Star Sacha Baron Cohen might get away with offending 9/10 of the country. We'll see what percentage is amused. Neda Ulibi, NPR News.
That is a complete list of people.
The idea for that was just such a quick little piece, but it came up when I went and saw Drag Me to Hell. And the trailer played in the movie theater, and there would be uproarious laughter from some people in the audience and complete chilly silence from other people. And I mentioned that to my editor, and this piece was the result. Well, from one offensive film to another, Woody Allen's latest movie is offensive only in that it's apparently really bad, or so says critic Kenneth Turan.
Woody Allen is back in his Manhattan home base for the first time in 5 films. His latest effort is a quasi-romantic comedy about the relationship between misanthropic genius Larry David and a dim-witted southern beauty queen turned young runaway, played by Evan Rachel Wood.
Well, my daddy says that America bends over backwards for the blacks because we feel guilty and it's crazy.
Oh, yeah, your daddy's a cracker. He's a bigot moron, your daddy.
Well, you're probably right because you're a genius, but you know, for a little Mississippi girl like me, this is really exciting. So what kind of genius are you anyway?
What kind? Quantum mechanics.
Yeah, but what field? Like music?
This script was apparently written by Allen more than 30 years ago with the great Zero Mostel in mind to star as terminally bitter Boris Yelnikov. That's Yelnikov with an emphasis on yell. It's not Mostel you will be imagining in this role, but the writer-director himself. Woody Allen's quiet presence would make the script's torrent of dyspeptic lines more palatable. Yelnikov's recitation of abuse quickly becomes more repetitive and tiresome than funny. How many times, after all, can you get a laugh by calling people imbeciles?
Don't send that cretin to me anymore. I can't teach an empty-headed zombie chess.
There's too much hard-edged savagery in Larry David's line readings, much more so than in his TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm, and it throws things out of balance.
I picked up the board and dumped the pieces on his head. As an object lesson to shake him out of his vegetable torpor.
Whatever works just doesn't work. There was a time in films like Manhattan and Hannah and Her Sisters when Allen's characters were both funny and recognizable human beings. The work necessary to accomplish that is something the writer-director can't be bothered with anymore. political scientists study Stalinism without Stalin, so maybe it's time for cinema PhDs to consider dissertations on Alanism without Alan.
While film scholars are fighting about Woody Allen, governments are fighting over the fate of the Elgin Marbles. Those are the beautiful, beautiful sculptures that are now at the British Museum. They were taken there from the Parthenon in the early 19th century by Lord Elgin. Now Greece has opened up a new museum at the Acropolis, and they would like to reunite the Elgin Marbles with the other 50% of the statuary that was originally in the Parthenon. Morning Edition's Steve Inskeep talked about the Elgin Marbles with Christopher Hitchens, who wrote about the fight over the Elgin Marbles in Vanity Fair. Steve noted that a lot of European museums are repatriating works of art that came from colonial countries. And he and Hitchens talked about why the British government has consistently turned down requests from Greece to restore the statuary to that country.
The British Museum has put out statements making a number of explanations for why they've declined this request, one of them simply being that vast numbers of people get an opportunity to see them in London.
Yes, which, as has been pointed out, would be a very good argument for moving the sculptures to Beijing, say. The main argument the British government used to have was that they weren't confident that the Greek government could look after them properly. Well, there was actually some truth to that. And there had been damage done to the sculpture that had stayed on the building. But those objections have now been met. They've been cleaned. They've been moved indoors into a climate-controlled, very beautiful gallery that has a direct view of the temple. The obvious natural home for all of them is Athens.
So have you had an opportunity to get a look at both halves of this giant set of sculptures, part in Athens, part in London?
Yes, I'm very much honored by a private view of the new museum. And it's been beautifully arranged with blanks left for the missing pieces. So you can walk around it and you can see with plaster casts what the story would be. And it makes you absolutely hungry to see friezes put together again.
We had another interview with another journalist, Leonard Pitts Jr., a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald, has thought deeply about fatherhood, and he's written about it, especially what it means to be a black father. He has a new book out, a novel, his first. It's called Before I Forget, and it, too, is about fatherhood. He spoke with Tell Me More's Michelle Martin.
You're right. It's become so commonplace as to be unremarkable, this phenomenon of children and mother on their own and dad as an infrequent drop-in visitor. What's your take on how we got to this point?
Well, my personal theory is that it is an unintended and negative byproduct of the feminist revolution and the sexual revolution. I think that one of the things that happened out of the feminist revolution was that we were taught that men and women are equal, which of course they are, but I think a lot of us took from that the other message, which is that men and women are the same. And I think that we have really bought into this myth in terms of the family, that if dad is not there, well, mom is just the same, and there's nothing that kids will miss if dad's not in the household. And the fact of the matter is, what we're finding out in statistics, and what we're finding out through just reams of anecdotal evidence, is that when dad's not in the household, there are things that kids miss.
You also write, in families characterized by strong black women and absent black men, it has given support to the disastrous notion that maybe fathers aren't really that necessary after all. And obviously you've spent a very great deal of time writing about why you think fathers are necessary, but why do you think that they are?
Well, the material answer to that would be that with father in the household, the family is less likely to live in poverty. It's a fact that we live in an economy where two incomes are definitely desirable over one. But I think above and beyond that, there are just all these intangibles that men bring to the household that have yet to be quantified. You know, the examples that I like to use from my own childhood or my own experience raising my kids is that when my daughter, who is now 18, brought her first boyfriend home, it was not my wife's job to take that boy up to the office and have a quiet man-to-man talk with him, to ask for his driver's license and let him see me scanning it into the computer, and to explain to him, you know, all the stuff that he's not going to do with my daughter if he wants to live to see voting age. That's not, you know, and it sounds like silly stuff, but it's important stuff, because in doing that, one, I put him on notice, but two, I tell my daughter that she is valued, and that's a dad function.
But there are those who would say that there are men who play a destructive role in relationships, and that families are better off if women have the ability to function without them.
If the man is a clear and present physical or emotional danger to the family, obviously get out. But those aren't the households that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the relationships where we have consciously devalued the presence of the man, or just decided that the man is not necessarily necessary. And it doesn't even mean that the woman and the man have to be together. What it means is that, assuming the father is of reasonably sound mind and character, should have access to his children because they need him, and they need him for more than just the financial benefit.
You can hear the full interview with Leonard Pitts Jr. at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
And while you're there, you can also visit a blog supreme. Felix, you just wrote a post up on that blog about a visit you took to the White House, and you did a piece about it as well, about a visit taken by music students around the country to see the First Lady temporarily turning the White House into a jazz conservatory, with middle and high school kids getting lectures and performance tips from professional jazz musicians.
The history of jazz in the White House stretches back many years, but the first concert took place right here in the East Room in 1962 when the Paul Winter Sextet performed at the invitation of then-First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy.
Now here's what we're going to do.
Almost five decades later, 150 budding jazz musicians have answered First Lady Michelle Obama's invitation to attend what the White House is calling a jazz studio.
We're going to play, and I'm going to point at y'all, and I want y'all to imitate four bars of the person that played before it. Now, this is an exercise for your hearing.
Trumpeter Wynton Marsalis stands on a makeshift stage between two massive paintings of George and Martha Washington that dominate the East Room. His workshop is hands-on, so he trades licks with high schoolers out to do their best. That was 14-year-old trumpeter Adam O'Farrell from LaGuardia High School for the Performing Arts in New York. Like most of the other young musicians, the setting and the history were a bit overwhelming.
I was kind of nervous, so I didn't think I played so well.
This is the first of three musical events that Mrs. Obama will host. Later on, she'll bring in country and classical musicians. With first daughters Malia and Sasha sitting in the front row, Mrs. Obama told the young musicians jazz has been a part of her life since she was a little girl.
At Christmas, birthdays, Easter, it didn't matter. There was jazz playing in our household. So it means so much to me to be able to bring that music here to the White House.
With that, saxophonist Paquito de Rivera introduced 14-year-old pianist Tony Madruga and his trio for a short concert capped off with the jam session on Dizzy Gillespie's Night in Tunisia. Felix Contreras, NPR News, Washington.
And Felix is one of the main brains behind NPR's new jazz blog, A Blog Supreme. If you like the story, you've got to check it out. It's at npr.org/A Blog Supreme.
And you can hear a different type of music in this next story. The Dirty Projectors is an experimental rock band with influences that range from early vocal music to modern R&B to punk. Critic Will Hermes thinks the band's new album is a breakthrough.
It's been about 30 years since the CBGB's era, since New York City has had a really vital rock scene. But they've sure got one now. Albums by Animal Collective and Grizzly Bear have already been flagged as two of this year's best. And I think another adventurous young band with Brooklyn roots, Dirty Projectors, has made a third.
Look around at everyone. Everyone looks alive and waiting. The wind is up, the stars are out. The sun is gone, the light is fading. But we are.
Dirty Projectors records can be playfully high concept. They include a song cycle whose storyline somehow involves Eagles singer Don Henley and a highly abstracted remake of the LP Rise Above by 80s punk rockers Black Flag. But Bit the Orca, a name the band chose mainly because they liked the sound of it, is more straightforward. It focuses on voices. The band has four of them, three female and one male. And while parts are influenced by modern R&B, the arrangements are far different. The single, Stillness is the Move, for example, strikes me as a bit like Destiny's Child teaming up with Talking Heads.
After all that we've been through, I know that I will always have you from now until forever, baby. I can't imagine anything better after all that we've been through. I know we'll make it until the way the question is a dream.
I've enjoyed other records by Dirty Projectors, but sometimes they seem too eager to show off their smarts. Their latest doesn't overthink, or rather, overthinks just enough to balance head and heart. The mix of tart strangeness and melodic sugar in their vocals reminds me of how much depth the best pop acts bring to their art, and it makes me hope that Dirty Projectors are in it for the long haul. Up in the light of the
That last song, man.
It's beautiful.
Where's the one?
You know,
there was no... It was really crafted. You couldn't tell where the first beat was. It was like recycled. I mean, like things layered on top of each other. It was pretty amazing.
Felix, I think you're taking us out.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Felix Contreras.
And I'm Neda Ulavi.
Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Snow globe.